appreciate your being with us, and would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal and argument on the cross-appeal regarding attorney's fees.
Yes, ma'am. We're ready when you are.
Thank you. May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Julie Day. I am from Kuhlin Sharp Autry & Day in Fairfax, and I am the substitute attorney for General Peter DeLuca, now retired from the U.S. Army, who is your appellant today. The brief statement of facts in this case is that this is an appeal from a show cause proceeding in Amherst County in which there was enforcement of a property settlement agreement drafted without the direct assistance of counsel. The action was brought by Mrs. DeLuca against General DeLuca. The operative language in that agreement was to be enforced was that the husband shall support the wife in the manner to which she is accustomed and currently being supported, recognizing the need of the wife to educate and nurture their minor child. A declaratory judgment action seeking determination of a support amount was brought at the same time as the rule of show cause by Mrs. DeLuca seeking enforcement for General DeLuca's failure to meet his obligations.
This is Judge Petty. I want to ask you about a very preliminary matter before considering the actual arguments involved, and I recognize that you were not the author of the opening brief in this case, but the wife has raised a 5A20 objection to the sufficiency of the brief. I note that it cites two cases for very general propositions and one statute in the dictionary. How do we decide this case in your favor without becoming, in effect, advocates for your cause?
Well, Your Honor, I understand the 5A20 objection there. Without becoming advocates, the question here is an issue of rule of law. There are four arguments, and particularly arguments 1 and 3 are rule of law questions, and they're based on the interpretation of the terms of the contract itself and how that interplays
with standard.
Is this 2109?
Is this an ambiguous contract? Is it an unambiguous
this is not.
Contract? What is the standard we apply to each? There's a ton of legal issues that we would have to address, and we would bear the responsibility of doing the legal research to support those arguments. And as I said, effectively, we would have to write the appellant's brief for him.
Your Honor, I disagree with that statement to this degree. If there's an error of law, the court is entitled to reverse the ruling and remand with instructions to proceed. And in this case, the facts that were put in front of the trial court remain largely the same. They may need to have additional rulings. But the court merely needs to give guidance to say there was an error of law, and the law is this. The court had to, number one, it correctly assessed that it had to retroactively assess what was the state of her affairs as of the date the parties entered into this agreement. But what's missing is step two, which is to what degree not could she expect a dollar amount, but to what degree did the actual actions of the parties and the actions of General DeLuca meet the standard of living that was established back in January 2008. And the court really needs to look at this as it's a two-step analysis, and the lower court missed step two, so it needs to remand to engage with step two. It was an error of law to assign a dollar value instead of doing the step two analysis, and the facts actually exist. This is a
what
fact.
What is your legal support for that argument?
My legal support for that argument, Your Honor, is 2109 and the interplay with this particular clause, which unfortunately is very poorly drafted in the settlement agreement. The agreement says that 2109 requires that the court enter its rulings in accord with the terms of this agreement. And the agreement says he'll support her in the manner to which she is accustomed and currently being supported. The court correctly ruled in its declaratory judgment proceeding that it could not make a ruling as to the dollar amount that she could expect, that it had to retroactively look. It was also correct in ruling.
This is Judge Huff, if I may. If we are to apply a plain meaning of the contract terms, and this one is headed spousal support, wouldn't that typically be expressed in a monetary amount?
Well, Your Honor, typically if it said spousal support, but it says he shall support her in the manner to which she is accustomed. And this entire contract, and you must read the entire contract together, includes many other areas of support. He maintained her in for insurance for her vehicle. He maintained paying the mortgage. This was truly a pure lifestyle maintenance here, and it's not specifically only dollars.
If it were not an expression that could be reduced to dollars, then what was this lifestyle? Was it that she got to live on the farm? And if so, that's covered by paragraph 1 of the PSA, isn't it?
It is covered by paragraph 1 of the PSA. The lifestyle at that point in time also, though, Your Honor, need to remember, it included the fact that she was home educating, she was homeschooling the child, and that's why the second language in this this agreement is there. So it is a lifestyle. It is not just money, and assigning a dollar amount, what happened when the court entered its letter opinion of April 25th, it said it assigned the dollar amount for up to 2008, which is fine. But then it said she can now expect to also receive $4,373 a month, and that's where the court committed the error. We need to reverse that second part. And so to back to the earlier question, what's my authority for the two parts? The court itself made a two-part ruling, but the second part is what's in error. So it needs to go back and redo part two in accordance with the terms of this agreement. And the parties
did. What do you believe the appropriate amount of spousal support for the court to award?
Your Honor, the document itself doesn't allow for the award of a support amount, and so what has to happen is you have to look for it. Unfortunately, the right ruling in this case means that these parties do continue to litigate over it, because you can only retrospectively analyze, did she receive enough money to maintain the farm? Did she receive enough money to do the things that she was doing as compared to back in 2008?
But
so it's unfortunately a sliding scale.
It seems to me that what you're arguing is that the husband gets to give her whatever amount he pleases.
Not what he pleases. He is held to a standard later of whether or not he met her standard of living. And you know, again, we're bound by the terms of an agreement that was drafted by parties who are not represented by counsel, which is very unfortunate, and this is what happens. And they will have to litigate retroactively.
Let me ask you on issue 4, and I realize this may be out of order for you, but I want to make sure that I'm understanding that issue, that and it's on the calculation of arrearage. The arrearage calculations were done from the time of the entering into the contract, the PSA, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that was several years before the entry of the divorce decree. Is it that the difference between those two dates that is at issue in issue number 4? It was unclear to me.
That's exactly correct. The final decree, when a final order is entered, in order for a reservation of rights to take effect, it's got to be clear and explicit. And Mr. Ward argued that as a black letter law issue. There is legal authority for that in Brin versus Brin, which is at 147 Virginia 277, page 288. It's a 1927 case, also in a divorce case. But the logic is this. The final decree of divorce in this case recited that the cause was final as of the date of entry in January 2013. That decree contains no language in its rulings mentioning any reservation to later determine arrears, and the only language referencing arrearages appears in an addendum to the order stated separately from the court's rulings and recites that the order contains no determination of arrearages but doesn't reserve the right to determine them later. So since the final decree does not
incorporate without merging the PSA as part of the divorce decree.
It incorporates without merging, but it does not reserve the right at that point in time to determine arrearages. And there was no matter pending about arrearages at that point in time. What she's done is we've got the parties divorced, and then they came back, and they're trying to enforce for a period of time that predates the entry of the final decree. And that period of time, she's waived her right to seek arrearages because there was nothing pending during that time.
Could that be done as a separate contract action since the contract was not merged into the divorce decree?
It could conceivably, but that's not precisely what has happened here. And
might have a statute of limitations issue, too. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking out loud. But
right, 5 years.
At any rate.
So that's a jurisdictional issue, and it, to wrap that particular item up.
Okay.
Go ahead.
No, please, go ahead.
Well, the relief, we've jumped around a little bit. We've covered most of the legal arguments here. The issue here is that the 2109C, and this applies to Argument 1 and Argument 3, 2109C mandates that any support order entered after the parties have entered into a settlement agreement must comply with the terms of that agreement. And so if this court entered an order that doesn't comply with the written terms, then the ruling can't stand. And this goes back to my analysis of the step one, step two. The court did take a two-step process. It just erred in step two. It didn't make the proper analysis, both in determining that there should be a dollar amount awarded and that she could expect that money to be awarded on a continuing basis after 2008, and also in failing to take into account the fact that the party's son had aged out, because he did age out and was no longer being homeschooled at some point during the proceedings, you know, before the final hearing was heard in this last year. And that, too, is something that the parties contemplated as an issue. And the court was silent on the issue of the son's maturity in its order. So any remand would need to ask the court to make its consideration to take into account that particular fact as well. There's also the argument here that the court erred in assigning assigning a value that included General DeLuca's non-combat pay. The period of time at which the court was evaluating his pay included the period 1 year prior to January 2008. The parties both testified that the pay for General DeLuca was increased for combat, and also he had other benefits and lack of taxation during his deployments. He testified that his take-home pay in the period before his June 2007 deployment was $8,600 a month. That's at page 390 of the appendix. And that his last deployment during the marriage ended in October of 2008.
Why is his income relevant to an analysis of what the wife's standard of living might be?
Your Honor, it's not directly relevant to the analysis of what her standard of living is in terms of do we base it on a dollar amount the way we traditionally would calculate? His ability to pay is not at issue. However, in its retrospective analysis, the court necessarily, in determining what she did receive, has to figure out what he was paid. It was netting out what dollar amounts were received in the bank account at that point in time. So it's not a direct issue, but at that point in time, the court was looking at two different types of pay that he received. And there was testimony that it was extraordinary that he would receive combat pay and the tax benefits during that period of time, and that it would be more appropriate for the first 6 months of 2007, his take-home pay, to have been considered at that point in time. And, you know, once the court in this case established a dollar amount that she should receive going forward, Well, he had, and the court had, in fact, taken into account my client's earnings, even though it's not directly relevant. The court made it relevant there. Excuse me.
You're into your rebuttal time, which is fine, of course, but just want to call that to your attention.
I will reserve that time. Will there be separate time for conclusion, or are we completed?
You'll have 2 minutes left to,
okay.
And that's it.
I'll reserve the rest of the time for rebuttal and conclusion,
right.
Then.
Thank you. Mr. Moore?
Yes, thank you very much. And can you hear me okay?
Yeah, Mr. Moore, if you're on speakerphone, could you pick up a handset? It's a little clearer that way for us.
Is that better?
Much better.
Yes.
Much
okay. Better. Sorry about that. May it please court, my name is Brian Moore. I'm with the Moore Law Firm in Lynchburg, Virginia. And in responding today, I want to talk briefly about some of the facts raised by the issues raised by the appellant, but I certainly want to address the issue we raised as well. And as for the agreement and the court's findings, we think this is pretty straightforward, and we thought the court was very clear in how it approached the issues in this case. The court ruled as a matter of law that the agreement required a retrospective analysis. It's just a traditional fact-finding inquiry. And it was doing this in order to determine as a matter of fact what support the wife was accustomed to when the agreement was entered. And it's hard to think of anything more consistent with the language of their agreement than that. Some retroactive analysis had to be performed at some time to determine, you know, what the arrearages were. And I think that applies somewhat to the arrearages going back to the date of an agreement as well, because there's no time at the time of the decree. There was no way to determine arrearages because this fact-finding had never occurred. But this is a factual finding that's subject to an abuse of discretion standard. And all of the evidence that was presented in court supports the court's finding. In fact, our evidence actually would support a finding that he was paying much more than the court found as the average for the 2 years subsequent to the agreement. But here we have a court just making a finding of fact. And it's really that straightforward as far as I can see.
Mr. Moore, is there a difference between amounts paid to the wife at the time or income available to the wife at the time of the separation agreement was entered and her standard of living? I mean, if she's putting money in the bank, for instance, and not spending it, is that a component of standard of living?
I would say that it is, and in fact, I think if you were to take the appellant's argument to its conclusion, one would almost have to say that he would owe her more than just the amounts that he was giving her in terms of money. But I would say that, yes, that would be a part of her standard of living, and that's what we were measuring here. They didn't set an amount, but we look back, and part of her standard of living at the time this agreement was entered was receiving this $4,000. We actually had argued it was closer to $6,000. Dollars per month on average of income from the general. But I would say, yes, it would certainly be a component of standard of living, but if you add other things into that, which I don't know, there's evidence of too many additional things that she was receiving from him that weren't already covered in the agreement, then it may even be higher. But I would say absolutely this money would be a part of that standard of living. This is what she was accustomed to, was receiving deposits into her bank account or checks. This is what she was accustomed to and the manner in which she was being supported at the time of the agreement.
Mr. Moore, this is Judge Huff. If we're bound by the terms of the PSA, the PSA, as I recall, is silent as to an award of fees, and you have asked for an award of fees here. How do you support that, given that the contract is silent on fees?
Well, Your Honor, the issue of attorney's fees, I think, is very important in this case. The court relied on Rutledge in denying the request for attorney's fees, and that's Rutledge's well-known case, of course, and in that case, the issue was a modification of support. This is a voluntary action brought by the parties to adjust their rights. In this case, we have our client who's had to go to court to enforce a court order and an agreement. It's something she's being forced to do, and something that traditionally an award of attorney's fees is allowed for if that party prevails. And it makes sense because it's sort of an incentive to a person to violate an order if attorney's fees cannot be awarded. So if the agreement is silent,
but But to the extent that it's treated as a contract action, the absence of a fee provision would mean that there's no basis upon which to award fees.
Well, Your Honor, I would think in a case like Rutledge, I would agree, because that was modification. But here we're talking about, again, enforcement of an order where the right to an award of fees is a part of prior court orders and rulings and sort of the history of enforcement of court orders. I would say that there needs to be a explicit waiver of that right. That right exists to ask for an award and to be awarded attorney's fees if you prevail in an enforcement proceeding. So unless you explicitly waive that right in an agreement, and we see agreements and we write agreements that do that, but unless there's an explicit waiver or of that right continues to exist. The fact that it's not mentioned, in other words, if you had to, it wouldn't make sense that you would have to state a right that already exists in an agreement for it to continue to exist. If it's not mentioned, it should still exist as it would in any other circumstance. If I'm hitting that the right way that you want to approach it, but I'm saying that right's already there. If it's not mentioned in the agreement, then it can't be taken away by the agreement.
All right. I understand your argument. Thank you.
And so, and I think this is, and I'm trying to touch on this the right way, but it seems like there's a public policy issue to this, and that, again, is we're not just talking about, you know, a person having a right to go back to court voluntarily to adjust their rights, but we're talking about the enforcement of court orders and how important it is for people to follow court orders, and this long-standing right for persons, and this is captured in 2099, of course. It says a court may award fees as equity and justice may require in a divorce action. And in a show cause like this, a contempt proceeding, you are reinstating the case. And so this is part of a divorce proceeding. It's enforcing an order entered as part of a divorce proceeding. So this ability for the court to award fees is there. And again, our position is, if that's not explicitly waived by the parties in an agreement, if it's not touched on at all by the agreement, then it can't simply just disappear.
Have we addressed that issue before in the context of a situation like this in enforcement?
Your Honor, I have not found a case that addressed that specifically. And if there is a case, I would be happy to review that. But I have not found one. I have found cases, and I think it's clear that the court has the authority to award attorney's fees and contempt proceedings. I think that's established by a number of cases, and I've cited those in my brief. I think the question here, and something that I don't think has been addressed anywhere, and that's why I think this is such an important possible ruling for the Court of Appeals here, is that we're distinguishing this from Rutledge. The voluntary proceedings is one thing, but taking a positive right, especially one that protects people who are supposed to be able to rely on court orders,
Let me ask you about, you say as a matter of right, isn't this an abuse of discretion standard of review?
Well, Your Honor, I think abuse of discretion would apply if a court reviewed the issues and said, I don't think either party's entitled to attorney's fees under the facts of this case. But here the court specifically said in its ruling that under Rutledge, it had to, as a matter of law, deny the request for attorney's fees. Now, I think on remand, the court could look at this and say, well, given the issues involved and the positions of the parties, I don't think attorney's fees are appropriate. Then I think that would be reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard. But when the court says, in its own order, that attorney's fees request is denied under Rutledge because it's been addressed in the party's agreement, that's an interpretation of the agreement. That's subject to de novo review. And that's the distinction I would draw there. And I think that's important because their agreement does not address enforcement. It addresses attorney's fees for the divorce. And so, Judge, that's why I've set forth the standard as de novo. And I do understand if the court had gone further and said, hey, I've looked at this, you know, they both were on, this was a tough case and there were some disputed issues here. I think they both have to pay their own attorney's fees. That would be abuse of discretion. But in this particular instance, and under these specific facts and the ruling of the court, this is a de novo standard of review, and that's why we think it's distinguishable from the standard abuse of discretion review that we see in so many of these. And if it pleases the court, you know, my brief, I've sort of covered our position on these things. If there are more questions, I'd be happy to answer those. But I think we've set everything forth about as clearly and succinctly as we can. But this attorney's fees issue, we ask the court to consider very carefully because it is distinguishable from Rutledge, and there are very important rights involved here. To say that if parties don't explicitly in agreement reserve their right to an award of attorney's fees, then they lose that right is a very big deal, and this is something that could apply to a lot of cases. To say if you don't reserve a right, which normally you would have anyway, but if you don't reserve it in an agreement, then you lose it. That just doesn't make sense, and especially with what's at stake here. And there are a lot of people who will suffer because they cannot afford to go to court to enforce valid court orders because they didn't reserve a right in some agreement they entered into an award of attorney's fees. Whereas if they had no agreement whatsoever, that right would exist. And so we ask the court to draw that that distinction and to rule that attorney's fees, at least in this case, were authorized. And on review, on remand, the court could decide whether or not they're appropriate. And if there's disagreement on the court's ruling in that regard, again, that would be an abuse of discretion standard if we were to appeal the court's decision on that. And I'll rest at that.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Moore. Ms.
Thank
Day,
you.
2 minutes remaining.
Thank you. I want to address the issue of the attorney's fees. Your Honor, with due respect, the agreement is not silent on the issue of fees, and I'd like to invite the court to paragraphs 14 and 17 at page 20 of the record. The attorney fees paragraph is 17, which says each party shall pay his or her attorney's fees, and the parties shall divide equally the cost of any uncontested divorce proceeding filed by either husband or wife. But also it needs to be read in conjunction with 14, which is a general release, which says the parties mutually release each other, their property and the estate, from all other claims, whether in law or equity, including without limitation any claim of equitable distribution and any claim under the Virginia augmented estate laws. Reading the agreement together, it does, in fact, carry provisions about attorney's fees, and the Rutledge Court did, in fact, address precisely the question that Your Honor asked a bit earlier. In that case, there was a provision for attorney's fees if there were an enforcement of the case, but not if there were a modification of spousal support. And in the modification, the wife was arguing that she should have been, there was an argument that they should have been awarded fees. In that case, the argument was exactly Mr. Moore's argument, that because the agreement did not address the award of attorney's fees incurred for modification, that the court was not restricted. The court's power to award attorney's fees was not restricted. And the court of appeals in that case said, we disagree. Once you have an agreement that recites something about attorney's fees, then 2109 becomes operative, and the court may only enter orders that are in accord with the terms of the party's agreement. And so that trumps the rules, the provisions of 2099 and the other statutory references of Mr. Moore. And so the issue of attorney's fees, there should be no attorney's fees awarded because the parties did not contemplate it in the contract, and they did not expressly waive the right to have them awarded previously. And while I understand Mr. Moore's argument, this is not a case in which there is no recitation regarding attorney's fees. So the parties did have the opportunity and chose not to do so here.
You're within 10 seconds of the end of your time.
I'll rest, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate the argument. The case is submitted, and you'll be hearing from us shortly. The court will now adjourn and go into conference. Thank you.